to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here for today's show. I'm C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest, and I've written some stuff, and I've been a professor of philosophy and a real estate investor and so forth. I do have something to share, though. I've got an event that I'm helping to run, and I'm going to be speaking at. It's going to be in Huntsville, Alabama, October 17th. It's the Apostle Paul's School of Tent Making, or something like that. So if you're a pastor and you have an interest in learning a little bit more about what tent making actually is from the Apostle Paul's point of view and how that might be helpful in a range of ways in the pastoral ministry, there'll be a link in the show notes and you can sign up for that. And you don't even have to be a pastor to be part of it, but it is originally designed to address pastors, but anybody that's maybe interested in a side gig that could like develop into a livelihood is welcome. Anyway, enough about me. How about you, Tom?
I take it that conference isn't about encouraging people to build more tents and make them and live under bridges.
So. Yeah, right.
The aim is to avoid that.
yeah, that's actually a great way to put it.
And I thought he was referring to Burning Man.
Yeah, that's been in the news a little bit here lately.
I'm Tom Price. I teach systematic theology, philosophy, Christian ethics, one of the places Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. And locally, right now, I'm teaching intro to philosophy to some fresh undergrads at a local university, which have not yet been corrupted by the rest of the coursework, so it's all rather right. Fun.
Okay, good. Well, you know, there's been so much pushback, you know, in the culture at large against wokeism. I'm anticipating maybe a turning of the page a little bit on all that, maybe some sense coming back. Anyway, that's a whole other matter. But Glenn.
I'm Glenn Sunshine. I am a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, ministry associate at Reflections Ministries. I've got my own 501c3 called Every Square Inch Ministries. I'm a freelance speaker, writer, a whole bunch of other things that I'm having trouble keeping up with.
Yeah, it's a busy time. For all of us, but fun too. Anyway, today is my day. We don't have a guest today. We've had a number of interviews here recently, and we're looking forward to another one in just a few weeks with Patrick Deneen, the author of Why Liberalism Failed and Regime Change. And in light of that, Pat's a friend of mine. We haven't seen each other for a long time. It's been like 5 years. But he's coming on the show at the end of the month, and in light of that, I thought, well, let's see what he's up to. He's actually a contributor to the Post-Liberal Order, which is a Substack, on Substack, obviously. And he posted something here just the other day entitled In Defense of Order, Part 1. And he makes some observations that I think are really kind of noteworthy, things to keep in mind, and that is when we think about conservatives, one of the people that, for people who are informed about sort of the, you know, scholarship in the 20th century and sort of leading lights when it comes to the recovery of conservatism, Russell Kirk is right at the top. And he wrote on the subject of order. In fact, the title of a book that he wrote was The Roots of American Order, which was published in 1974. Let me go ahead and read the opening paragraphs of Pat's treatment. By the way, Pat teaches at Notre Dame. He's a political philosopher. And his book, that I already noted, Why Liberalism Failed, was a huge runaway hit. It was a bestseller. It was actually blurbed by Obama. Knowing Pat, I don't think he shied away from that, but at the same time, he's not an Obama supporter. But anyway, so let me this is actually from an address he gave at ISI, the Institute for Intercollegiate Studies, is it? Or no, let me see, ISI.
Intercollegiate Studies Institute.
Yes, Intercollegiate Studies Institute. That's it. I thought, that's not an S. Anyway, which is an important organization that works with college faculty and students and sponsors summer retreats and summer internships and brings in top-level scholars from all over the United States and beyond to lecture. And so Pat was there to lecture, and this is how his lecture began. Let me begin by noting a remarkable fact that we are devoting this week to the theme of Russell Kirk's book, The Roots of American Order. The book was published in 1974, shortly before the political ascendancy of modern conservatism with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. While that vindication of Kirk's long efforts lay some years in the future, the book appeared in the wake of the establishment of a number of what were to become legacy conservative institutions. Given the minor focus on order among those institutions, Kirk's book was already out of tune in that expanding ecosystem of what was becoming establishment conservatism. Then, as now, the emphasis of institutional conservatism was upon liberty or freedom, two words often used interchangeably, especially individual and economic liberty or freedom. For all the claims of defending the variety of viewpoints that arise from a market society, these institutions are remarkably homogeneous, indeed, essentially indistinguishable in their unstinting invocations of the central value of liberty, while remarkably silent when it comes to a commendation of order. Kirk's book was, in a sense, already out of fashion from the moment it was published. Then he goes into a list of purpose statements by different, what he calls establishment or legacy conservative institutions. There's the Heritage Foundation, and here's how the Heritage Foundation describes itself or defines itself: free enterprise, limited government, individual freedom, traditional American values, and a strong national defense. These are the values that we fight for every single day. Yeah, and they do. I've been impressed with them over the years. Then the American Enterprise Institute, quote, a public policy think tank dedicated to defending human dignity, expanding human potential, and building a free world. Next, Cato Institute, which no surprise would put the stress on liberty. The vision of the Cato Institute is to create free, open, and civil societies founded on libertarian principles. And obviously, libertarians would lead with liberty. And then it goes on, you know, the Institute of Humane Studies, Young America's Foundation, Hudson Institute, Fund for American Studies, Liberty Fund, Law and Liberty, Acton Institute, and so forth. But in every case, liberty is what you lead with those organizations. And order is either unmentioned or just merely implied. So what do you guys take with regard to that? Can we have liberty without order?
No.
Okay, great. End of the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah. Next question. What's interesting is if you actually read the Acton Institute's material rather than just their statement on their webpage, they talk about actually a very old expression, ordered liberty.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is important. I know it through Acton and through the people who I've worked with over there. The idea is that liberty is the goal, but liberty can only be achieved in a state that is ordered properly, because without the proper ordering, liberty turns to license, and people start preying on each other and all of those sorts of things.
Right. So you don't stay free very long if freedom is the only, value.
Right. And when we're talking about liberty, again, this is something we've talked about, I don't know how many times, but liberty and freedom are not the same concept exactly.
Yeah.
We conflate the two, but liberty is a narrower idea than freedom is.
Yeah, I think that's what Pat was kind of implying when he kind of tongue-in-cheek or maybe as an aside said these are terms that are being used interchangeably. I know he would know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, he would know the difference. Yeah. Just as a reminder, or maybe the first time if we've got a new listener here, the idea of liberty is, you know, the classic definition is the freedom to make choices within the boundaries set by divine and natural law.
Right.
So liberty cannot exist in the absence of boundaries, in the absence of parameters. So if you look at the Garden of Eden, you can eat any tree but that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you didn't have the but that one, you wouldn't have a state of liberty. You'd have a state of license, freedom to do just anything you wanted to without restraint.
Yeah, and even that particular story, you, I think, have a tradition of interpretation that maintains that the temptation was to make up your own rules, in effect.
Yeah.
The knowledge of good and evil is not just simply the experience of evil and good, but actually the freedom to define those terms.
Yeah, so anyway. I think what knowing from what I've read of Deneen and others committed to similar work, and I share a lot of those assumptions and criticisms of certain variants of libertarianism and certain views of conservatism and liberalism, even certain views of classic liberalism. What do I mean? If we kind of go into my territory with metaphysics, let's put it this way. What classical understandings of human freedom were grounded in, especially Western civilization and Christianity's contribution, was the fact that we have natures, human nature, and then we are able to enact that nature in various ways. That's what choosing is about. It's taking, you know, enacting our nature this way rather than that way. And what happens with the notion of liberty and freedom that enters into these newer pictures, if you will, is that it tends to conceive the human almost strictly voluntaristically, which means the nature doesn't really govern the choice or the freedom to make a choice, but rather the choice is the significant thing about us, and anything natural outside or about ourselves needs to follow that. So there is nothing governing. There's no intelligible nature that I have that I need to consider when I enact my choices. And so what that does is makes what often is called an unpremised view of choice. It has nothing governing or directing it other than maybe something base or some bad appetite, right? And so that's the problem with it. Whereas formed choice and freedom is governed by the intelligibility of natures and purposes, and that freedom is a truthful enactment of what our nature is to perfect and realize it. And so institutions, formative institutions, are those that help underwrite and foster that and allow a society to cultivate that, whereas one that merely, you know, sets the groundwork for this kind of a radical libertarianism, or one that doesn't consider form, leads exactly where we've talked about, even to as Mike Hanby will argue, nihilism as a right. Total concept.
One of the things that you brought out there, Tom, is that, you know, this choice is going to be informed by something. It's going to either be informed by some passion, and then in that case, or something else. But in the case of passion, it's either going to be informed by something horrendous, like a wicked passion or evil passion, or we've got to have a kind of, I guess, Pollyannish view of human nature, which is it's just, you know, we're just all nice, you know, deep down inside, we're just little children wanting to be loved, that kind of stuff, you know. Yeah, it's Rousseau again, you know, that, yeah. You know, his unfallen noble savage is really, I think, something that has a powerful influence in our world today. I mean, you talk to, you see all the stuff that's going on with the alphabet soup people, and basically that's their way of operating. There's no such thing as wicked desires, except of course those that white straight men have.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I want to say I'm glad you brought up Rousseau. Except I'm not. Right. But Rousseau, there's a really interesting way in which Rousseau is the anti-Augustine.
Yeah.
Rousseau wrote a book called The Confessions.
Right.
You know, which was his response to what Augustine did in his Confessions.
Yeah.
Rousseau's idea that we are innocent until society corrupts us is a direct contradiction to Augustine, who says, well, society is corrupt because we're corrupt.
Yeah, and society also has an important role in restraining us.
Right.
So it may not be able to perfect us, but at least it can keep us from getting as bad as we could be.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the key thing with Augustine is, in this regard, is Augustinian psychology, which is something I wish we would recover.
Yeah. Yeah.
Augustine's core idea is that our choices are conditioned by what he calls the weight of our love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We, you know, desire is, our desires are at the root of our will, which means that if we do take libertarian free will, our corrupt desires will inevitably lead us to make corrupt choices.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is, of our own free will, we may choose anything other than God because we will never accept God on God's own terms.
Yeah.
And it isn't until God intervenes and changes our hearts that we will, by our free will, respond to him. You know, so in this way, Augustine preserves free will on the one hand, but also predestination. Because he doesn't understand will as being this free-floating thing untied to our desires.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, stepping back from this a little bit, and as you think about why conservative institutions, and I know people who are connected with a number of these institutions, they would not agree in agreement with everything we've said. It's not as though they're against order. They understand how important order is for liberty. But, you know, they're trying to make a case for conservatism in an environment that's not willing to listen very closely and is sort of stubbornly hostile to the essential core convictions that we're getting at right now. So it's almost as though you got to lead with liberty. I mean, if you're going up against the libertines, you know, and it's not entirely evident yet just how bad things can get under their sort of control. Yeah. There's a paradox, the control of the libertines. That's what we live with right now. The thing you start with is where you think you're most likely to get the best reception. Let's put the stress on liberty. Let's put the accent there. We all know that order is super significant, right? But those folks out there don't know. And if we lead with that, they won't even give us any time to make our case. So do you think I'm onto something with that, or am I being too sympathetic?
Well, I think that definitely the catering tends towards somehow expressing conservatism so that it will be palatable, just like, but I think, you know, I think one of the things Dineen does, at least from the stuff I remember reading, is he kind of taps in the territory no one likes to tap. And what I mean by that is he likes to go to those places that basically show that a lot of the verbal agreements versus underpinning commitments are different. And so a lot of conservatism in its attempt to accommodate itself or make itself palatable actually carries along with it a lot of the assumptions that it in otherwise would or should reject. And in doing so, they actually make a hybrid, a form of conservatism that really is underwritten by philosophical and metaphysical assumptions that later on do it in. And so it will not have the capacity to do what proper form and institutions and orientation of our actions should do. Now, the flip side is with the left-leaning or the liberal or the libertarian, with their strong emphasis on freedom, Deneen will also note is that on one hand, they want that freedom to be to break out of any kind of rigid forms that kind of hamper certain things that we should as choosing agents be able to pick. But the flip side is the chaotic consequence of that leads to the imposition of a stronger form that isn't in accord with our natures and actually is very much against our natures. And therefore, it becomes totalitarian rather than allowing our natures to truly, and society to truly unfold.
That's the big paradox. This is something that the, you know, that, you know, the classic philosophers noted, you know, that this, you know, this sort of progression ultimately in pursuit of an unformed freedom leads to the worst kind of totalitarianism or tyranny. They wouldn't have used the term totalitarians, but the tyranny in our time, it's worse. In other words, totalitarianism, I was just reading James Burnham's book, The Managerial Revolt, which was published in 1941. And in that, you know, he's making the observation that totalitarianism is something that maybe people like Genghis Khan wish they could have pulled off, but they didn't have the facility to do so. They didn't have the technology to do so, and now we do. But that's 1941. You know, he was noting that. So what we see kind of developing is this libertine edge of our society is the means by which, or the paradoxically, the means by which totalitarianism is seeping into to our world. Anyway, go ahead, Glenn.
I'm going to bring us back to Rousseau.
Okay.
Rousseau does something in his books that is really sleazy on the one hand, but is very instructive on the other. He redefines the word freedom. And for Rousseau, he says that freedom is submission to the general will.
Right.
In other words, it doesn't have anything really to do with the individual or the individual's desires. Freedom is submission to the general will. Now, this is a definition of freedom that nobody really buys.
Yeah.
Except he defines it and then spends the rest of his treatise talking about freedom. And because of the connotations of the word, words have a denotation, its formal meaning, a connotation, the sort of emotional and other things that are carried with that meaning. He relies on even though he's changed the denotation completely, he relies on the connotation of the word freedom to carry his argument.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why that's right, now propagandists and advertisers do this kind of thing constantly. The reason why that's important is that in a lot of ways, it may be that conservatives are falling into a trap that in some ways is laid for them by Rousseau in their discussion of freedom and liberty and all of that as a way of trying to carry the argument, but they don't bring with it the essential things on a proper definition of liberty, or for that matter, the insistence on order that goes with that proper definition of liberty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in a lot of ways, they play into the hands, well, as Tom said, they're setting themselves up by importing ideas that will ultimately lead to their undoing.
So let's play a little bit with this in the sense that in the course of my life, there have been a couple of times where we've arrived at a cultural moment where people were fed up with chaos and, a very forthright call for order was made and people were happy. I'm thinking about, the late 60s, early 70s with a lot of the chaos that you saw then, you know, there was a, you know, law and order party, or at least that's how it was sometimes characterized. I'm talking about the Republican Party as being the party of law and order, because people were sick of lawlessness. I think about, you know, the early 90s as well, with the crack epidemic and a lot of the social unrest that we see, you know, sort of an encore of today. But there were some politicians like Rudy Giuliani who just came out and said, okay, we got to establish order here. And people were glad. But people couldn't put up with it very long, I guess, or maybe the strong sort of libertine, you know, sort of impulse eventually just revives and you get it happening again.
All right. I want to suggest that you're missing something important here.
Okay, go for it.
If you look at New York, where Giuliani was doing his work with broken window policing and all of that sort of thing, he established a degree of order within the city that, frankly, pretty much everybody loved. And it was only in the context of him having established that kind of order that they could start complaining about how he was doing it.
Well, I agree.
So yeah. it was the success of the, I don't want to say imposition, but the establishment of a system of order that provided the stability for people to begin complaining about all kinds of other things, which has now led to its complete undoing.
Yeah, and there was a lot of, I guess work in the shadows with regard to the politics of libertinism. They were looking for their chance. They were looking for the moment that they could seize and return to the, you know, the insanity of their own programs. And now, you know, the question I have at this point is, will there be someone with the kind of courage and charisma to take advantage of the current insanity? I'm not seeing anything that gives me a whole lot of confidence. Maybe you know, someone like Ron DeSantis down in Florida, but apart from that here or a little bit there, I don't have a sense that we're on the cusp of some major recovery or sort of cultural renewal, if you get my drift.
Yeah,
I did have a sense of that in the early 90s, though.
Yeah. Well, I think right now, and I still think there are certain threads in the earlier 90s that are gone now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes the pressing theological question significant. And this is why I think theologians have started to hone in on this. Especially in terms of ethics and politics, it's that what you have typically going back and forth here is the kind of two polarities of the flesh, right? On the one hand, as Paul tells us in Romans 8, you've got law, right? But legalistically understood, almost oppressive against our rebellious natures. So then you have the kind of Democrat in today's world wants to emphasize liberty, right, and protect it at all costs and hinder any kind of limit on it that legalism, if you will impose or bad form in its mind. But then it gets so bad that it flips back to the law and order figure. But I think figures like Dineen are trying to basically say that's because what you're dealing with are two bad understandings and practices and institutional structured, you know, a whole society structured around this kind of back and forth play between a bad understanding of reality and a bad way of working with form and liberty. And that even though both are significant, there are, you know, his whole point in Schindler and other figures is to make a case for a better balancing act. And I think one that does justice to our natures in a real way.
Yeah, and he's going to get to in this article some of the things you've already brought up, Tom. Just to kind of fill listeners in, Pat is a Tocqueville scholar, so he draws heavily on him. He's Roman Catholic, and he's very much, you know, in the Thomist sort of frame of mind. But he's also, like a number of thinkers today, you know, you bring up the work that theologians and philosophers are engaged in at the moment. He's trying to understand the roots of our disorder by looking at philosophical moves that were, you know, that occurred in the past. So, yes. You know, his take, I think, on the nominalist and voluntarism would be exactly the same as yours, Tom, and ours. Yes. He's also pretty critical of Locke.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's gotten him into a lot of, trouble. I don't mean in a bad sense, but just in the sense that that's the thing that he is, you know, that's the person he's looking at and criticizing that other people are defending, like Joshua. We had Joshua Mitchell on. In fact, Joshua didn't mention, if I remember correctly, Pat directly, but he made a comment, and I thought, you're talking about Pat Dineen.
Well, and this is where you have your difference growing up, you know, within trying to resolve kind of solutions within varieties of conservatism between kind of either a return to this kind of, you know, this better, purer form, as they'll argue, of classical liberalism versus one that thinks, no, we can't go back because there was already problems as ingredients within that classical mix that are showing themselves now. So it is a deep philosophical and metaphysical and theological debate. And so this is why the philosophical and the theological have become so serious within these conversations.
So let me just summarize the gist of his most famous book, Why Liberalism Failed. The answer is because it succeeded. In other words, we got what was... you know, in the mix from the start. He's saying, you know, we made a recipe and we put it in the oven and we open up the oven and we don't like how it turned out. Well, his response is, well, how'd you think it would turn out? You know, these are the things that were in the mix. Yeah. Now, I think that we can get into some really good analysis of, you know, what was going on, say, in Locke's mind and that kind of stuff. And that's worthwhile doing. We should do that when he's on the show with us. But I can tell you're itching.
Maybe
to
we could
say
get
something.
Locke on the show, since we want to know what was going on.
I can tell you're itching to say something, though, Glenn.
Well, yeah. I think a lot depends on what you're looking at in Locke. There are certain things where Locke is completely off the rails.
Yeah.
But there are certain elements of it that I would argue, as I did in Slaying Leviathan, that I would argue that he actually successfully synthesizes a lot of Christian political theology that had come before him. Whereas before, a number of these areas, unalienable rights, covenant theories of government, resistance theory, were sort of separate categories. He's the one who figured out a way, with some predecessors, but he's the one who figures out a way to really unite them.
Yeah.
And in
yeah.
that sense, I think Locke did a great job.
Right.
There are other things I would
notion of the human being, especially the kind that could lead to a certain kind of strong emphasis on the individual and freedom in a kind of voluntaristic or kind of atomized way. And whether he's I'm not a Locke scholar. I mean, I've read enough, again, to find problematic some things and interesting others. But I think that's where their point of contention sits. I don't think they would say, you know, I think every contribution was bad. I think most would be committed to certain views of things post-Locke.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to – go ahead, Glenn.
Another quick direction, though, that we'd moved off of. Whether there's a turning point happening?
Yeah.
This week, and it'll be old news by the time the show comes out, but this week, Adams, mayor of New York, has come out and basically said, New York can't take any more immigrants. It's going to destroy the city, but there's no end in sight.
Yeah.
Now, this is the guy who ran on a platform of making New York a sanctuary city.
Right.
And apparently Biden is trying to pull his bacon out of the fire by prohibiting Texas from sending people to other states.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep the problem in Texas. We're not going to let it hit these Democratic strongholds. It's not going to work. San Francisco, similarly, is falling apart.
Yeah, the thing is there's a lot of ruin in the ruin of a country. Now, I can't remember that, but I think it's Burke. And what you have is a weird kind of codependency, with a particular political arrangement where you have very wealthy, powerful elites who use democratic politics as a cover for their own selfish reasons. Yeah. So they can signal, I'm a compassionate person, and they've got the money to pay their own for their own security and all that kind of stuff. And then you have, just utterly dependent people who, for one reason or another, are dependent on the largesse of the state. And then you've got the politicians who are being, served by both party, both groups, just the masses who vote for them and the money that is fed to them. And so this provides a tremendous cover. And a lot of folks have just given up. I mean, they're just moving away. Middle class has just died out in some of these places.
Right. But the question is whether those who have no choice or whatever, who have to stay, whether there's going to be some sort of backlash.
Well,
I agree. I don't know what that will look like, but it seems like it's going to have to happen.
Well, I agree. But, something that Tom said a minute ago is certain things have changed. One of those things is that a lot of the people who supported law and order in the past are dead. In other words, we don't have a large group of World War II vets voting anymore.
And I think that, one of the things I know from ethical discussions in the theological world is I think there has also been first of all, this is kind of common criticism of traditionalist evangelicals or Protestants for that matter. They don't typically have a unified voice on anything. They have very fragmented schools and positions, but a lot of times the place where the church could speak and Christians could speak, especially around the issue of immigration in society, we basically let the better, more compassionate way of dealing with things get drowned out and just keep taking punches when we say, this kind of immigration policy, it isn't compassionate. It isn't good for anybody. It's not good for the people that are being flooded here, ripped from their families and homelands where they prefer to be. And it is causing all kinds of harm to them. They become vulnerable, open to trafficking, drugs. There isn't a lot of employment opportunities. So it's a horrific tragedy.
Well, getting back to my comment about there being a whole lot of ruin.
Yeah.
Haiti has been a basket case for 200 years.
Yeah.
And you could say, well, they've never learned. Well, there are a lot of forces in play that prevent the tiny minority of sane people from actually winning. The situation that we face in the United States, in my mind, is tipping that way. Now, there are places where there's still a strong kind of common sense realism.
Yeah.
But not in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Not in New York City.
Would you like to know how to set up a privatized banking system that will help you separate from the mainstream banking juggernaut and avoid subjecting your hard-earned money to the whims of Wall Street? Join a growing community of like-minded individuals and business owners who leverage these privatized banking systems to use the same money in more than one place at the same time, while also enjoying tax-free growth and a plan for multi-generational wealth building. To find out more, contact today's sponsor, Private Family Banking Partners, at protectyourmoneynow.net. That's protectyourmoneynow.net, where you can download their free ebook or set up a free 30-minute consultation. See the show notes for additional information.
I do want to get to this question of what are we talking about with regard to order? Glenn And you have both done a good job of speaking to it. But I want to quote Pat here and show how he's dealing with it. So he says, according to the Indispensable Online Etymological Dictionary, I admit I've gone there many times. The word order originated from a few root concepts, one with some remarkable connotations and related ideas. So from the Latin, nominative ordo, row, line, rank, series, pattern, arrangement, routine. Originally as, quote, a row of threads in a loom. That's fascinating. From the Proto-Italic, orden, row, order, source also of ordere, to begin to weave. Then he goes on to note that the words ordain and ordination also are derived from this root. So the word order, as it's expressed through ordain and ordination, quote, a body of persons living under a religious discipline, end of quote. The verb order from ordren originally meant, quote, to give commands for or to instruct authoritatively, end of quote, as well as to, quote, command to be made, done, or issued, end of quote. All of these meanings accord with the core conservative understanding that the human domain ought rightly to be a reflection of the order of creation itself. So there is, as you noted, Tom, a order already present.
Yeah.
And that what we're talking about here is not one group of humans imposing their own ideas about what order should be on another group, as much as it is acknowledging the order that already exists before any of us showed up.
And the way that, I mean, when we talk about metaphysics of creation, the way Christians understand it in that order, think of just Genesis and the laying out of these things, be fruitful, multiply. They're all so interconnected, you know, the nature of the family with it being the principal context for the procreative and the nurturing and the carrying it out and the responsibilities to generations, right? Well, what you have there is when that is enacted in accord with the created design and purposes, the living it out in that order is basically the way in which creation is porous to those aspects of divine sourcing and giving that allow it to flourish and move it towards its perfection and even supernatural end, which fulfills it, if you will. So when you break that, that porousness of the created is it's eclipsed. It's turned in on itself. It's not drying off. If you just think of a plant being able to see the sun the right way versus not, right? It starts to wither, die, disease, get, and the same thing happens with society and social institutions and anything else for that matter. And so creation is never autonomous or pure in the sense that it doesn't absolutely depend continuously on the source for it to flourish and move it along the right way. And order understood the right way, and society ordered the right way, and as Glenn mentioned before, and loves, right, related to all that the right way, is the flourishing and the salvific context. Anything short of that is a problematic, and you know, it may be we have to tolerate it while it's not in its perfect form, but we still should be pressing things to flourish.
Yeah, the problem that we face, though, is that, you know, we've talked about the problem of skepticism. You know, you did a couple of great shows, Glenn, on some, skeptics in history. And when we don't trust our authorities, who are, you know, trying to convey to us the nature of the ordered reality we find ourselves in, we just kind of write it all off as, so you're just trying to protect your own interests. You know, you're just, you're not really telling us the way things are. You're telling us the way things are if, you know, when they are in your interest. And so because that deep skeptical distrust is so present at the moment, it's almost invincible, if you get my drift. I mean, people are damaging themselves in the name of this liberty. In other words, it goes that far. People are willing to mutilate their own bodies because they can't reconcile themselves to the fact that there is an order.
Yeah, it's worth noting that in Genesis 1:2, it says, after God created the heaven and the earth was formless and empty. And then the rest of the creation narrative, the first 3 days, God is forming the creation, and then the second 3 days, he's filling it. Okay, so he's solving the two problems of it being formless and empty. When you reject order, what you are fundamentally trying to do is to return the earth to its formless shape.
Right.
You are fundamentally attacking the very nature of creation.
Yeah. Yeah, Philip Reeve, that's where he ends up, you know, in all of his work, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, you know, and his other books. That's where he takes us. He takes you back to the spirit over the waters, and we imagine ourselves to be that spirit now. And we believe that we can kind of divide the waters and make what we please.
And because that, basically, that formlessness and void is just simply sheer potentiality, right? Undifferentiated being, you know. If we could get back to that in our fallen states, that makes us very happy because it makes us gods over it, right? To give it the form and the fashion. That's why it's what Henri Blocher used to always say. This is why you have this kind of chaotic move towards the primal and the chaotic in all these mystery religions and sexual cults. Because they think that is where the kind of energy source is that drives life, where we basically become the determiners of everything. And so you constantly see it, whether it's in, you know, cult or politics.
Yeah.
And but I think that the notion of, you know, you mentioned about skepticism, and you know, this is where I guess the pressing point of our immediate challenge is. And I think this is where, you know, certain lectures I remember Mike Hamby given and others, there is a certain side where you kind of despair because it's happening at a rate faster than we can keep up with it. So the damage is going to have to be done before the conditions are there again to hear, listen, or anything else. But he said in the process, we still keep to doing what we do as pointing to the light, enacting truthfulness in our marriages, and trying to build or at least enact within our faith communities and the like, and help support those institutions and forms that at least hold and refract some of that truth, beauty, and goodness that we need to get through it.
Yeah, I mean, I see this all the time. I mean, you'll find people who maybe grew up in a very disordered Christian home, where perhaps some manipulative people were pursuing their own, you know, fallen desires or you know, allowing those to govern them and so doing oppress everybody around them. And they would often be the first to appeal to the authority of Scripture for, you know, parental authority and that kind of thing. And what ends up happening is you get these kids, you know, who've grown up in an environment like that, and they hear the Scriptures and they can't trust. They can't trust because of what has occurred. Now, it used to be let me put it this way. There have always been bad fathers. I mean, it's not like bad fathers were invented 100 years ago or something like that. There have always been tyrannical men. There have always been good men. But there's always been an understanding, I think, or at least a prevalent enough way of thinking that you separated the larger order from the particular situation you found yourself in. You say, well, the reason why I can call him a bad father is because he's not actually reflecting the fatherhood of God. So when it comes to how do we address a situation where the skepticism is just so ubiquitous outside the church, inside the church, one of the things that you see a lot of the winsome crowd try is, well, we're just not even going to talk about order anymore. We're just going to talk about love and freedom and self-actualization, that kind
of stuff. But see, this is that point. I have this little article that I've been kind of working on where relating to that whole notion of negative world, right? The church finds itself in negative world. But long before it became negative, religion, evangelical religion, became ugly. And its ugliness was because it was basically not imaging forth God in the world and beauty and all the riches it's been given, but it's basically become a worse form of secularism and popular culture and everything else. It's simply ugly.
Yeah, well, I'm going to pull that back to, 19th century. What you see happening in the 19th century among liberal theologians is a call to sola scriptura, but their definition of sola scriptura is more solo scriptura. All we need is the Bible. We don't need any of the, order that's provided by tradition, by our understanding, by the historic creeds or anything like that. The first people who make the argument for Bible alone apart from creeds, the first people who do this systematically are the liberals. And what you're seeing there is a rejection. It's the same sort of thing. It's a rejection of tradition in favor of a libertarian interpretation of scripture. I can do this any way I want to. The Bible, it means what it means to me.
Yeah.
And that has passed from the 19th century liberals, that's become almost mainstream American evangelicalism today.
All right.
And again, it's the same thing we're talking about, this rejection of order done in a different sphere.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think another thing that we need to see develop is a renewed faith in a human ability to apprehend reality as it is, not just simply as it's understood today as that's your point of view, perspectivalism something stronger like Kantianism, like you're just, imposing order on, a set of meaningless sense data, and it's your mind that's creating the order and not a perception of order in the world itself. We have to get beyond that kind of skepticism. I had a discouraging conversation with a very intelligent and connected lawyer yesterday, and in the course of the conversation, we were talking about Logos, and I had assumed that he had a classic understanding of Logos, but as the conversation unfolded, I came to see that it was actually a much more modern way of thinking about it, and I just kind of something in me died. I was like, this guy is stabbed in the heart. Yeah, because this guy is like a very significant thinker and super guy. He's a super guy. I'm not saying he's not a super guy, but it is sort of like, okay, that's the state of affairs. I'm assuming that it's a reflection of a prevailing way of thinking amongst even the most educated and effective lawyers.
And I think those are the variations of that are holding place for us, but they're not full enough in terms of their metaphysical commitments and theological commitments. And there is a kind of, nihilism and modernism and scientism are totalitarian. They are about the whole under them, their core principles as first truth. We as Christians are as well. The question is, what first truth is the one that actually is true, set first, but secondly, allows the true metaphysic of creation to not move towards the chaotic and the void and the destructive and the anti-civilizational, nor to become fascist or totalitarian in unhealthy ways, but actually the perfection of natures that are already inclined in directions as creatures towards which we can begin to read and understand and learn and gain intelligibility of and orient ourselves towards. We just don't want to listen to it. And that's, you know, that's another big issue. That's the Augustinian point. We're recalcitrant rebels.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in terms of the recovery, I'm reading right now. I'm working my way through Second Chronicles, and you know, I've come to Hezekiah's story, and the revival that occurs under Hezekiah is sudden, you know, mm-hmm. and the narrator notes how sudden it was, mm-hmm. and one of the things you get when you read, you know, First and Second Kings, First and Second Chronicles, First and Second Samuel, is there are these little indicators every once in a while that just sort of like open up a window, and you see it was a lot worse than I thought, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, references to male prostitutes in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and that, you know, finally they're being addressed, you know, and punished, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's like, okay, well, how long had that been going on?
Well, you'll notice what in every revival in Israel up to Josiah, the very last one,
yeah.
all the high places were left.
Yeah, yeah, they were never complete. Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, Hezekiah is almost too little too late for all of his good, you know, sort of points. You know, he's what, only two or three kings from the end, you know, the Babylonian captivity. And that's the thing I fear is this, you know, the too little too late, and how long these things can go on. I mean, so like Hezekiah reinstitutes the Passover. What are you telling me that in the lifetimes of all these people that had never been celebrated? Yes, that's what's being said. And, you know, I think a lot of us as Christians, when we look back at, you know, Judaism and the experience of the Hebrews and the Old Testament Israel, we have this idea that, you know, it was pretty much things kind of going like, you know, normal.
Yeah. We assume that just because Moses gave the law, people followed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think about that the next time you're driving on a highway and look at the speed limit signs.
or you get these references to, oh, and by the way, we found this book, buried under some stuff in the temple. Yeah. What is it? It's the law.
Yeah.
How long have you been going without it? You know, that's the thing that occurs to you.
Yeah.
But you never told. It's just like, everybody knows that, you know, this had been neglected for a long, long time. But, you know, for us as readers today, we don't know that.
Yeah, and we kind
I guess the thing that's encouraging is just how quick that was, that recovery.
And for us, it, you know, especially in, you know, contemporary evangelical worlds and things, I think there's this, you know, there's another kind of problem that can be very similar in its results, and it's this over domesticated reading of the text that allows it to us to have as moderns, a buffer between its reality and our trusting it, what we pick and choose is valuable for us. And so our hermeneutical grid is already, you know, distanced from that text. And I do, this is why we talk so much about the participatory nature of creation and our relation to God, is because it's a way of reconnecting to reality in ways to hear that biblical text, the way it communicates our connectedness to these things. And I do have glimpses of hope, figures. I mentioned Lewis, Chesterton, Tolkien. We do that all the time. They're not the whole solution to the problem, but they were able to recapture the imagination closer to the biblical vision of things that help us to navigate something greatly lost that we can begin in our work, in our focus, in our teaching to emphasize and build upon. So, I mean, if anything, there had to be figures at any time in redemptive history that were still carrying out things and building upon things, even when the text of Scripture was lost and everything else. And
yeah, you know, thinking of even just Tolkien and Lewis and, you know, their corpus, that's why they must be destroyed from the standpoint of many people today. I just groan every time I hear about a new Tolkien film or a new Lewis film, and who's being entrusted with these things. Do they have any... Do we have any confidence that they have any sympathy for the things that those writers stood for? I don't have any confidence in that. They're just using a kind of glib fanboy, superficial love of the aesthetic or the you know the heroic, and just taking it and running with it to pursue completely antithetical agendas.
They don't match the aesthetics of the work or the whatever else is going on, and they dull in it. I mean, I guess the most disturbing thing would be that people would think the works are so boring, like those attempts to depict it, that they won't read it. I mean, the flip side is those attempts to depict it are often so boring and banal, not many people watch them.
Well, you know, I just think about the fact that the gal who was the director of the Barbie film has been given responsibility for directing the new Narnia series.
Which worries the heck out of me. I don't know if you saw this, but Rings of Power, they did the analysis of it, the Amazon thing. Only 35% of the American audience watched the whole first season.
So hopefully they lost enough money, they won't try it again, but who knows?
Well, they sank $1 billion into it, so.
Yeah. Well, that's where we get back to there's a whole lot of ruin. You know, you have to burn through a lot of, you know, and here in the United States, we really don't have any challengers on the global stage. It appears as that the Russians are just paper tigers and that the Chinese might be too. And anyway, on that happy note, why don't we wrap it up? Thank you for listening to the Theology Pugcast. We appreciate your interest in our show. We want to thank a couple of new Patreon sponsors. Thank you very much. If you'd like to join the band, the merry band of Patreon supporters, we would really appreciate it. And you can follow the link in the show notes for that. And I guess that's all for now. We're going to be, interviewing Pat in a couple of weeks, but we've got a couple of other things coming up between now and then that are great. So we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Theology Pugcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you liked this podcast, you might enjoy another one of our podcasts, Got a Minute, featuring Larson Hicks and Rich Lusk, theology, philosophy, economics, politics, and more for normal people.